Good morning, and welcome to the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. I am Susan Thompson, your lay leader today. I'm also a member of your board. It is my pleasure today to participate in this service with fellow board members, Nell Newton, who is our worship leader, and Klondike Stedman, who will testify about stewardship. We are an intentionally inclusive congregation, and we welcome everyone to our church. Please join with me in affirming our mission statement, which is printed in our order of service and also beautifully printed on our wall. At First UU Church of Austin, we gather in community to nourish souls, transform lives, and do justice. Our opening reading is from Robert Walsh, a Unitarian Universalist minister, and is entitled Feeding and Being Fed. In my mid-50s, I became a single adult for the first time, wholly responsible for feeding myself. It was a journey of exploration and discovery. It was a land I had dwelt close to, been surrounded by all my life, but now I saw it with new eyes. One of my discoveries was the joy of feeding people. After some time spent developing the skills necessary to feed myself, I began to actually invite people into my home and serve them food that I had prepared. Not just an entree or appetizer or dessert, but a whole meal I had planned, shopped for, chopped, measured, mixed, cooked, and served. And these people sitting at my table ate the food I prepared. They took it into their bodies. I discovered that to do this for someone, to feed them, is to give life. The food gives life, and the person who prepares and serves the food gives life. I was a life giver. There were other discoveries: the sensual quality of food preparation, the colors and textures, the surprises of cutting vegetables open and seeing their inner patterns. Oh, how I loved bell peppers! I love the smells that fill the room as things began to braise or simmer or bake. And I discovered this: the person who receives the gift of the food gives a precious gift as well. It is the gift of trust, an affirmation of the life giver. Feeding the body is not all there is to giving life. We who gather in religious community give life, whether or not we have ever sliced a pepper. We transform ordinary entities: a bell, a flame, a touch of a hand, musical notes, a tear, words, a coffee cup, into spiritual sustenance. We serve it up and we eat. We are the feeders and we are those who are fed.
Good morning. I'm Dale Beulah, and I love to tell stories. Stories are not just for children, they're for everyone. And I have a story that I'd like to share with you this morning that I heard many, many, many years ago, and I think it's very apropos, and when Nell asked me to tell it, I said I'd be glad to. There was once a wise old man. Could have been a wise old woman. Could have been a Unitarian. And as he died, he began to move upward toward heaven, if heaven is upward. He arrived at the gates, and there was St. Peter standing before him, and he said, "Unitarians here?" He says, "Yes, but I have a favor to ask. Before I go into heaven, could you please grant me a wish?" And he said, "Well, why not? What is your wish? What would you like?" He said, "You know, I've always wondered what hell was like. Thought I might go there at one time, but you know, I would like to know what hell is like before I enter into heaven." And St. Peter smiled and he said, "Well, that's easy to do. Close your eyes and I will take you to hell and see what it is like and show you what you've missed out on." And with the blink of an eye, they crossed the river of Styx, and there Cerberus, the three-headed dog, as they entered into hell. And there, before the old man, stood a huge, huge table A banquet table loaded with food, piled high with fresh beans, carrots, fresh fruits and vegetables of all kinds, meat, potatoes, cornbread, sweet potatoes, everything you could imagine. The tables were loaded with food, and as the bell rang, the souls from hell came in to eat. But it was not a pretty sight. They were hardly able to walk. They were almost like walking skeletons as they came in to sit down at this table loaded with food. They were gaunt and weak, and some could hardly walk. As they sat down at the table, the man looked at the faces, and then he saw why they were so weak. As they reached for the food, their arms were locked and paralyzed, and they could not bend their arms to bring the food to their mouth. And as they sat there and they watched the food, they were in pain. They were in agony as all this food was before them, and not a drop could reach their lips. And the old man saw the pain in their faces and the anguish. He says, "I'm glad I'm not coming here, but I can't take it anymore. Please take me back." And St. Peter smiled, and within a moment they were there at the gates of heaven. "Come on in," he said, "and welcome." As the old man walked into the gates of heaven, he looked around, and my Lord, there was a banquet table. It looked exactly as the one he had just seen. It was loaded with food and fresh fruits and vegetables and all kinds of meats, sweets, cake, ice cream. And as the bell rang for the meal to begin, he watched the people come in to sit down at the table, and people were not the same. They were different. They were well-fed. They were happy. They had smiles on their faces. But as they sat down, he noticed their arms were all locked. They could not bend their arms to their mouth. He thought, why? Why? Why are they so well fed? And then he saw what they were doing. He reached out to the food, and they fed it to each other. And as they fed each other, the juice would run down their faces. And as they breathed in the wonderful smells, they shared one with the other and one with the other and one with the other until all was so full they could hardly move. And they smiled and get up to leave. You see, the giving is the difference.
It is my pleasure to introduce Klondike Stedman, our board president, secretary, sorry, I elevated you, soon maybe, who will give testimony about his relationship with the church.
There are two main reasons I now give to church. One is selfish, and the other is, well, the other is selfish too, but maybe not so much so. I say I now give to church because the reasons and my level of generosity have changed quite a bit over the years. The selfish reason I give is part of a continuing struggle to transform myself into a better person, a happier person, a more whole person, a more trusting person. You see, I have come to believe strongly that my best, perhaps my only hope for personal transformation comes through my own choices and actions. On any given day, I may not feel kind, generous, thoughtful, present, or any other attribute that I value, but if I take actions that are in line with my best intentions, I have found that the feeling is usually not far behind. Similarly, if I give in to my inner demons and act in ways that are petty or mean, it may take me days or weeks to pull out of that funk of selfishness. To borrow from the rich 12-step slogan bag, I can't think my way into right action, but I can act my way into right thinking. I recall vividly an email I sent to our former minister, Davidson Lohr, probably some 8 or 9 years ago in response to his call to the whole congregation to give generously, to give, as he called it, a half tithe, or 5% of pre-tax income. As a graduate student at the time, I was incensed that I would be asked to give the same percentage that, say, a doctor or a lawyer or an executive might give. How infinitely greater their wealth seemed than mine. They might need less than half their annual come, I reasoned, where I certainly needed nearly every penny of mine. What I did not realize at the time was that I was reifying, solidifying in my own mind a sense of scarcity, a lack of trust of the universe. Over the past 7 years since opening my own business, I've been forced time and again to confront these demons of fear and inadequacy as we have gone from begging for a loan to start our small music school with just 45 students to expanding yet again this year because with over 300 students, we've maxed out our current space. Because I realized at the beginning I was woefully unprepared to be a businessman or entrepreneur, I have made a study of the aspects of running a business the past few years, reading dozens of books and hiring a business coach, and the same message keeps coming back again and again. You cannot accept the gifts of the universe if you've closed your hand into a tight fist, holding on to what you have. You have to open your hand in a giving posture in order to receive what the universe has to offer you. By giving generously to something bigger than myself, something that matters, something I believe deeply in, I enlarge myself, I trust myself, and most of all, I trust you. I trust that my community will care for me if I am in need, and this gives me the courage to take opportunities when they come along. Let me give you an example of how this different mindset leads to a radically different result that just happened recently. Last January, I happened to see a door open in another part of a shopping center where my music school is located, and I poked my head in and saw the most appalling sight: a torn-up concrete floor, dozens of massive holes in the wall. The ceiling was collapsing, and the AC had died decades ago, so it was rotting, basically, from inside. On that day, I guess I was feeling particularly abundant, because without hesitation, I called Wendy, my wife, and said, "You've got to see this place. It would be perfect for our expansion." Now we have a beautiful new addition to our school. We've hired 5 new teachers, several of whom are absolutely transforming our business. We have the potential to more than double our earnings. And this never would have happened to that person who felt like a starving student. The other reason I give is only slightly less selfish, in that it benefits the larger world, but of course, that benefits me and my family as well. It came to me one night after Wendy and I had had dinner with some dear friends who have since left this church. One of them was saying something to the effect of, "Well, I've decided I don't really need a church. I have a community of friends. I volunteer regularly. I give to charity. That part of my life is really fulfilled." I couldn't put my finger on it at the dinner, but as we were lying in bed that night, it started to come to me what was wrong with the idea of us each just giving and doing our own part all by ourselves. First, I thought of a story that my martial art teacher, and Nell's as well, Master E, told of when he was a boy at the temple, serving his turn guarding the stores in winter. The temple headmaster happened to stop by to keep him company. Inexplicably, his master began to knock apart the warm fire, tossing a log here and there, until the fire had nearly burned out. My master, shivering, asked if he might be allowed to rebuild the fire, which his old master let him do. As the master was leaving the storehouse, he said, "See how much brighter the logs burn together? This is why we practice together." Then I thought of what Pastor Martin Niemöller famously said of the inactivity of German intellectuals during the rise of Nazism. "They came first for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for me, and by that time, there was no one left to speak up." Now I think of those young men who've taken their own lives, and what kind of difference it might have made if they had a community in which they knew they were accepted and valued for who they were. Finally, I started to think about what this city, this country, this world would be like without a church like ours and other liberal religious communities that are willing to take action on the values and mission that include such things as doing justice, valuing the worth and dignity of all beings, and the free and responsible search for truth, just to name a few. We can imagine, on the one hand, what a nightmarish world it would be without people willing to stand up for those values. Or we can imagine, on the other, what the world could be if such church had the resources to be a true flagship for those kinds of values. How we could transform lives for the better if we had the courage to be generous and trust that we are truly abundant and full of potential for greatness. What a difference we could make for ourselves, for our community, for our world. This is why I give.
If you'll please join me as we enter into a time of prayer. After performing the miracle of the loaves and fishes, Jesus and his disciples made a quick getaway in a boat to leave the Pharisees to argue among themselves. Once in the boat, the disciples realized that someone had forgotten to grab one of the 7 baskets of extra bread, and now there is only 1 loaf of bread among them. While Jesus was warning them against the leaven of the Pharisees, the leaven of Herod, the disciples fixated on that 1 loaf of bread. Jesus was not impressed. "Were you not paying attention? Do not you yet see or understand?" Now, you and I don't perform miracles. If there is a great crowd who have nothing to eat, we cannot break apart 7 loaves and expect more than crumbs to reach every mouth. So instead, we gather the flour and the water to bake more bread. Let us share our leavening among our neighbors, and let our efforts fill the hungry, empty places in our world. Great Spirit, I ask that we might each know the comforting weight of a small, smooth stone in our pocket, waiting for its chance to become soup. I ask this in the name of everything that is holy, and that is precisely everything. Amen, and blessed be. Well, good morning. I have to admit, this sermon is not about the joy of giving. Our minister came up with that title weeks ago and handed it to me about 2.5 weeks ago. And I said, "Great." And I ran home and I started writing about the joy of giving, and it didn't happen. It's like trying to force a poem. Come on. Sermons are much more crafted than you might realize. The joy of giving sermon never showed up. I asked it, and it didn't show up. Another one showed up. So that's the one that we have today. Have I told anyone recently how much I enjoy being past president of the Board of Trustees? It's really nice. It's kind of like grandma. As past president, I attend all the meetings, but I don't have a vote. Instead, I simply serve as an advisor, and I give an insight when asked. And if something gets messy, I just hand it to our current president, Eric. And he takes care of it beautifully and smilingly. It's very relaxing. And it's allowing me more time to do other things around the church that I enjoy, like washing dishes and greeting our guests and assisting with worship. From an imaginary posting on a website for Unitarian Universalist ministers. "Fun-loving, plus-sized church seeks compatible minister for long-term commitment and growth. Turn-ons, stimulating Sunday morning conversations and community engagement. Turn-offs, Calvinism and put-downs. Must-like self and others. Ability to nurture souls, transform lives, and do justice, a plus. Please, only serious inquiries. Or so that's how I imagine it might read if our search for a settled minister read like a personals ad. Instead, our settled minister search committee is preparing a detailed congregational report, a fat packet of information that will go out to ministers in search. Many will pore over it and try to imagine what it might be like if they came here. Some will realize quickly they are not up to the challenge. But several will lean forward and reread some sections excitedly and wonder, what would it be like to be with First Church Austin? But let's back up a bit. Susan Smith is the district executive who oversees the Unitarian Universalist churches for the southwestern U.S., and in a conversation, she explained that in some ways, the relationship between a congregation and a minister is a bit like a marriage. It's a covenantal relationship with shared goals built upon mutual respect. Like actual marriages, the joys are mixed with tough spots. But the agreement to stand in right relationship with one another helps keep both partners on track. And like actual marriages, the relationships generally end in either death or divorce. At the end of our last settled ministry, some of us wondered if we would ever feel such connection again. Others felt we might not even deserve such connection. And still others were ready to run out and find someone new right away. But have you ever been on a date with someone who's on the rebound? Over your dinner with a nice plate of otherwise really good fettuccine, you get to hear about that person's last love, their awful habits, their charming endurances, and then all of the disappointments, the betrayals, the bitterness that all accompanied the parting. It's enough to put you off your pasta. Congregations can behave much the same way, which is why the advisors from the Unitarian Universalist Association recommend we spend at least 2 years with interim ministers before calling our next settled minister. We were encouraged to play the field, so to speak, before making a serious commitment. Bring some new voices into your pulpit, they told us. Try out some new ways of doing things. Take some classes. Why don't you look hard at some of those old habits? Dream about your future. And that's exactly what we've been busy doing for the last 18 months. But all along, we've been looking forward to finding a special someone to share our dreams and our journey with. Now, unlike in other denominations, our congregations and ministers do not have arranged marriages. Our ministers aren't sent down from a central authority. There is no bishop to play matchmaker. Instead, like modern marriages, UU congregations and ministers choose one another after careful consideration. So, into those documents the search committee has prepared, they have compiled our most appealing attributes. They've also been frank about our weaknesses. Yes, we're attractive, but we're also modest and good company. The report and the packet are almost ready, and they will be sent out by the end of this month. They tell a rich story, and you are all in it. Your dreams are included in there because you've already given so much of yourselves. You participated in groups to build our covenant. You helped name our weaknesses. You participated to define our values and shape our mission. Many of you completed a survey on what you would like in our next minister. So your voices will come through loud and clear to anyone who reads through those pages. And I know I've said it again before, but thanks to the Settled Minister Search Committee for the hours that they have spent compiling this packet. I know it will represent us well. Now, like in a small town, In our small denomination, news travels fast, and most of the ministers know that First Church Austin is in search. Some have been waiting to see our documents for a long time. Would it work out with us? They wonder. Now, there's several months more of work ahead for the search committee. They will read many packets posted by ministers in search. They will listen to countless sermons. They will eventually travel to see the strongest candidates preach. And they will have many, many conversations. By next spring, it is likely that they will recommend a candidate for us. So what do the rest of us do in the meantime? Well, there are a few specific things we can do. We keep up with the self-improvement, those leadership development classes, our move to policy-based governance, getting rid of that other hive of bees in the back wall. And while this might not be an arranged marriage, there are still a few traditional touches that it's time to attend to. Namely, the trousseau and the dowry. Like birds and animals that line their nests by pulling fluff from their own breasts, this fall we will be making a nice, soft, warm budget to hold our visions and into which we can welcome our new minister. Now, in traditional communities, there are aunties and uncles who make sure that a good arrangement is made, and they will put up the extra resources to seal the deal. While the bride-to-be weaves and sews all the linens she'll need as a wife, the extended family sets aside extra resources to give the new couple a good start. One uncle provides a few extra goats. Another buys a modern stove for the couple's new home. Aunties will sew coins into the ceremonial garments and set aside extra food for the feast. Now, with all these preparations, family alliances are secured, and everyone deepens their commitment, not just to the couple, but to the community. Now that we're in the middle of our stewardship campaign, each of us has the chance to be the aunties and the uncles whose commitment to the community will seal the deal. Several of us have already dug a little deeper than usual to make our congregation's next budget look healthy and attractive. Because the search committee's documents will include that proposed budget based upon the results of this stewardship campaign, and you can be sure that interested candidates will look closely at that detail. And who would really want us if our budget was scrawny and underfunded? Are you in? Will you set aside a few extra goats? Will you come help stuff grape leaves for the feast? Will you raise your pledge just a bit to help secure your family's alliances and deepen your commitment to this union and this community? Ask yourself, what will you bring to the feast? And are you ready to be fed? The words for our benediction come from Ian Huntington Bear. You are the story of the world. You are the world coming to know itself. May you trust that all you will ever say or do belongs in the story of the world. Amen. Blessed be. Go in peace.
This is a presentation of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. For more information, visit our website at www.austinuu.org.